Hi, and welcome to another episode of Climate Tracker Weekly, where we hear stories that matter to young climate journalists around the world. I'm your host, Chris Wright, and in this episode, we talk to Kuratulain Tijani, a climate journalist from Karachi, Pakistan, who is currently in New York studying a master's in journalism. She shares her journey with me and what it's like to compare environmental crises in Pakistan and the United States. It's an interesting story, and I hope you enjoy the moments where I try to pronounce her name and really stumble over those syllables. But first, a quick roundup of the climate news around the world. One of the UK's leading environmental scientists has predictively slammed plans for a new coal mine in Cumbria in the United Kingdom. Professor Sir Robert Watson told The Guardian that the UK's lack of efforts to override a local council decision for the new coal mine was, quote, absolutely ridiculous. Of course, as you probably know, the UK is hosting a UN climate summit this year, and this looks pretty embarrassing. Over in Indonesia, more than 1,000 people have been forced to flee their homes due to monsoonal flooding. Vox did a great short video explaining the history of Jakarta's water mismanagement, and I really recommend it as a background to anyone trying to understand just why there are now so many vulnerable residents in the Indonesian capital. And obviously, our thoughts go out to everyone who might be struggling in Jakarta right now. At the world of the EU, it looks like they are considering debt reductions for countries that take climate action. According to Reuters, the IMF is working with the EU to reconsider debt burdens in places like Chad, Ethiopia, and Zambia, and maybe replace that debt if those countries take climate action. As a bit of context, the Seychelles in 2019 swapped its international debt to set up the world's largest marine reserve. That deal was also with the EU. Just as a note, though, it's not clear if China is interested in these talks, which is pretty important to places like Zambia and Ethiopia, both of which currently have big-time debts with China. Finally, in the United States, you might have seen that they've officially rejoined the UN climate negotiations last week. You've probably already seen as well that as they did it, a crazy snowstorm blanketed the country and knocked out power. One state that was really heavily affected was Texas, and the state's energy has basically been offline ever since. State energy officials attribute the massive power outages to losses from coal, natural gas, and nuclear energy. Wind turbine shutdowns also do appear to have accounted for a less than 13% of the outages. But of course, that hasn't stopped our friends at Fox News blaming the whole thing on energy blackouts associated with wind turbines and solar energy. This is an old play from Rupert Murdoch's media empire, who a few years ago tried to blame similar blackouts in South Australia, a state in Australia, on the state's solar power industry. The cause in that case, as in this case, was a massive storm that knocked out transmission lines. But obviously, that didn't stop Rupert Murdoch's affiliates in Australia blaming the whole thing on the state government installing solar panels everywhere. Ironically, at the time when they pushed hard on that kind of solar panels are evil line, the state offered Elon Musk an opportunity to come in over Twitter. Ironically, you know, rich people go on Twitter, they can apparently change the world. But the opportunity to come in, and over a year, he built a big battery, which was so effective, shored up the energy supply so well that there are now plans to build another 30 more across Australia. So my thoughts also go out to people in Texas suffering right now. But if there is any lesson from Australia, there is potentially a real opportunity to massively increase your battery storage after this storm. I hope that becomes a scenario for you guys over there. If not, I just kind of, it looks like crazy scenes, and I hope you're able to kind of actually bunker down and get through this next couple of days, which I'm sure really, really suck. We turn now over to our interview with Kuratulain Tijani, and I hope you really enjoy the discussion. And thank you so much for sticking around with our podcast another week. I'm here with Kuratulain Tijani. How are we going, Kuratulain?
Things are well. It's 12:21 a.m. Past midnight in New York City, where I'm tuning in from at the moment. But it has started to snow outside a little bit, and it's blanketed with snow. Looks nice from my window at the moment.
And what brought you to New York City?
So I am at the moment, I'm pursuing my graduate program from NYU. I'm doing my master's in journalism, and my concentration is called Reporting the Nation, Reporting New York. So it's all about, you know, trying to find local stories from New York and, you know, from around the area.
Oh, great. And how has that experience been different from your experience back home?
In terms of grad school, because I pursued my undergrad degree from Pakistan, and that was in business administration, and this one is in journalism. So you can see the difference there. But in terms of the degree, of course, it's very, very hands-on and practical. When we are, you know, pursuing the program, we are all actually professional journalists, you know, reporting in the field from day one. So last semester also, when the very first course and the very first class that we started from was all about reporting, and we started with a story. And, you know, so it's a lot of, you know, getting your hands dirty and trying to do things, experimentation. It's great.
Yeah, that's probably kind of exactly why you're there, right?
Absolutely.
I like to start off a lot of these interviews with a bit of an open-ended question. Obviously, we all have a different story, a different reason why we do what we do, why we are who we are. What's your story?
The person that I was back then and the person that I am now are very different. I actually went through some experiences in life. I used to be married, and there were things that went a little bonkers in the relationship. But then, you know, that really made me realize who I am and who I really want to be as a person. And after that chapter in my life, I really started advocating for a lot of different causes. For example, I really started, you know, being very vocal about gender and gender issues and equality and gender-based violence. And then that sort of steered me towards other causes in life. Environment was one of them. I actually have another story, which I will talk about in a bit. But yeah, so I had a few of those experiences, and then I really wanted to sort of, you know, do something using my skills. So I was like, you know, when I was in school, I was sort of always good with words, and like, you know, got a little validation from my teachers here and there. And, you know, my father is also a writing teacher. He teaches writing in the US also, and he engages with a lot of different groups in Pakistan and Karachi. So got a little validation in terms of, you know, being good with words. And then it slowly dawned upon me that, you know, I really wanted to use the skill to do whatever I can best for humanity. And so I landed where I am today.
And was there anything before you maybe even did your undergraduate that you had a kind of an inkling that you wanted to do journalism later on in life? Some people have kind of an early childhood experience that kind of drew them towards journalism. And I guess maybe for yourself, it's much later. But was there anything kind of even before you did your business degree that kind of made you think maybe journalism is for me?
So I don't think that I was entirely certain that this is what I wanted to pursue, but I always liked writing. Like journaling a little bit was also something that I used to do. But then right around the time when I started my undergrad degree, actually, I started a blog, and that's where I started getting a little more into, you know, writing my thoughts out and, you know, getting published. And I actually started off as, you know, a reviewer, and I wrote about this drama series that was on. It was very popular at that time, you know, trending on Twitter and everything. And so I attempted at it. I reviewed it and sent it to this major publication. They published my review, and that's when I was like, you know, okay, this could be something that I can pursue. And, you know, but like for a girl who is, you know, in her early 20s, getting a byline is just something that, you know, she just like in earlier days, some of the people who I talked to, they said that, you know, if somebody would get a byline in a newspaper, they would just cut that out and they would, you know, laminate that and frame it on their walls, you know. So it's just, that was something really, you know, positive as an experience. But then later on, you know, I started tweeting also, and trying to find different platforms to sort of get the word out there. But yeah, gradually, like, you know, tweeting a lot, putting out statuses on Facebook, you know, in terms of whatever I used to feel, commenting on news events, anything and everything. And then later on in life, a few years ago, that is when I decided that I wanted to pursue this full time.
And I don't mean to pry, but obviously you're originally from Pakistan. And is it very common for kind of young women to be interested in journalism in Pakistan and be able to kind of publish independently?
A lot of people are getting into the blogging space now. Like there are lots of influencers and micro influencers who have, like, people have Instagrams and people have Twitter accounts. And like, it's very easy to start a blog now. Like I remember when I started 10, 12 years ago, it was very different. But now there is a lot of, you know, digital awareness and literacy, and people know that they have all of these different platforms where they can publish. But in terms of women opting to be a journalist, there are quite a few. Like you do see a lot of anchors and, you know, reporters on TV pursuing this. And there are lots of people who write columns also, lots of different women who do that. But if you talk about the general public, medicine is a more preferred degree for women for various reasons, like, you know, science and medicine and, you know, and a lot of women opt to be teachers as well, which is actually, I really wanted to be a teacher when I was a kid, you know. So yeah, those are the preferred professions. But having said that, there is a lot of, you know, literacy when it comes to media, and people do understand that there are lots of different platforms in terms of social media that they have to express their opinions and, you know, have their voices heard.
Okay, well, I mean, that's great to hear. And obviously that was a misperception on my part. As someone who is getting into kind of journalism later in life, was that something that maybe friends and family of yours questioned? Obviously, you know, some people might imagine that you have more opportunities with a business degree than with a journalism degree.
To be honest, not really. Like, I mean, my journey has been sort of, you know, so after I did my business degree, I got into, you know, social media management, and I worked at some agencies where I did some sponsored content also. I got my hands dirty with PR as well. I was a blogger myself, and then I managed PR projects for different brands and clients. And then it went on to, then journalism became my passion. But with regards to my family and friends, I think they were always very supportive. My dad has been the most supportive person, my siblings, my mom, you know, they were always like, you know, you pursue whatever you want to do. And they saw that, you know, I got so passionate about this, like a few years back, and, you know, there was no stopping me after that. But they've always encouraged, like, you know, in terms of pursuing this passion. Yeah, I do remember having a few conversations with friends. Like, this was around the time when I was very, very vocal on social media, especially on my Facebook. And then, you know, my friends would be like, you know, you should watch out for what you say. You know, you may get into trouble, because in Pakistan, there is, you know, a lot of restriction on freedom of speech sometimes, you know, especially for bloggers and journalists. Like, it's a little dangerous at times, especially if you step into certain themes and certain discussions that you're not supposed to have on social media. Like, it's really discouraged. So I do remember my friends telling me, you know, not to be that vocal and try to keep the big picture in mind and, you know, focus on the causes that I can really do something about, instead of, you know, getting abducted and, you know, killed or whatever. But yeah, I mean.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about kind of climate coverage in general in Pakistan. What is it like in general? Is the media kind of often reporting stories around climate change? Is it kind of reported in a particular way?
Yeah, okay. So from my observation, what I've seen is that a lot of these major news outlets and publications, they focus a lot on the news aspect of climate. So for example, if there is like an announcement on the EV policy, like the electric vehicle policy from, you know, the government, there will be like a news story on that and, you know, until the point of coverage of news. But then I do feel that there are a lot of different stories, like, you know, with respect to climate, there are themes that are unexplored. And there are lots of human interest stories that deserve a little more coverage. I also feel that the science bit in climate stories, like, you know, when a news report is compiled, it's just, you know, answering all the WH questions and then that's it. But with regards to climate, I think there needs to be a little more context, a little more, you know, explanation of why what's happening is happening, and, you know, digging a little more into the detail, just so that people understand what they're reading.
Okay. And what do you think that you can do to kind of try to help improve that space?
So I talk a lot about humanizing climate stories also, like on an international level as well. I feel that even a person like me who has had, who has studied science until grade 12, you know, like I studied science until high school. There are still times when I feel that the concepts need to be simplified a little more, like, you know, they should pass the grandma test. So I think that, you know, a little more characters into climate coverage, you know, really going to people and talking to them a little more, understanding how it's impacting them. There needs to be a little more of that, not that it's not out there already, but, you know, that needs to be built on a little more. And also the science, it needs to be simplified for the common person, because, you know, climate change impacts a common person at the end of the day, you know, and for them to make sense of what's happening around them, it needs to be simplified a little so that, you know, the reporting and the journalism does a service to people.
What is kind of going on in terms of climate change in Pakistan? Obviously, there was quite a kind of horrible kind of dam break through some glacial melt in kind of northern India recently. You know, the Himalayas across, you know, the region really are kind of causing incredible instability for water access and for kind of, you know, mountain communities across the region. What are some of the unique climate impacts in Pakistan right now?
Pakistan as a country, actually, it enjoys all the different seasons, and the geography is, you know, set in a way that different parts of the country experience different, you know, issues when it comes to climate change. So for example, the really urban cities, they get, you know, a lot of urban flooding. Then we have a lot of, you know, deforestation, because of which there is accumulation of smog in, you know, in the winter season as well. I also did a piece on the smog and air quality in Lahore in 2019, around October, November, somewhere around that. So that is one thing. And then obviously there is, you know, the fact that there is deforestation that is also impacting the climate space altogether. Then there are heat waves in the urban parts. What else? Lengthened summers is also something, very, very erratic rain patterns. In a recent press conference, actually, the special assistant to Prime Minister, he talked about, you know, the fact that Pakistan has seen 1% increase in the average temperatures, which obviously he was trying to explain to the people that, you know, it doesn't seem like a lot, but it has a lot of negative impacts when it comes to, you know, the climate on a whole. And then you also have to really look at the fact that Pakistan is an agricultural economy. So being an agrarian economy, obviously there are impacts on, you know, the food security, and there's water shortage because of, you know, the severe weather events, and there are droughts. So, you know, a lot of the cities and a lot of places, a lot of areas in Pakistan, they face acute water shortages also, which is, you know, contributing to a lot of different issues. Like my story actually on for the my very first story for Climate Tracker actually was about, you know, the impact that water shortage and brackish water, the availability of brackish water, has on women in Karachi. So there are all of these different issues that we see around, and, you know, people generally, like when there are heat waves, they try to, you know, make sense of what's happening. But yeah, they really need to be, you know, educated on, and there needs to be a little more awareness campaign on, you know, what's happening.
I guess kind of you are now hopefully trying to pick up the slack of kind of, you know, the challenges of reporting on these types of issues. What is it that you kind of really want to report on in the future? What is it like, what do you want your mark on kind of climate reporting in Pakistan to be?
Honestly, my dream project would actually be to talk to climate migrants, you know, because there's a lot of climate migration around the world, and not just like, you know, in Pakistan. Like, I would like to go around the world and talk to refugees and like people who've gone through war also, but then more importantly, people who witnessed extreme weather events or the impacts of climate change. So that is something that I really want to do, and it would be like a dream project. I actually recently did, like last year only, 2020 in November, I talked to a few people from Louisiana on, you know, all the like survivors of hurricanes Laura and Delta. And I talked to them about, you know, and this was obviously months after the hurricanes had struck. So, you know, I really wanted to talk to them and try to understand what it's like even months after, you know, the hurricane struck. And it was very insightful. Like, you know, some people really shared some horror stories from where they were living. And they were like, you know, there was no electricity. There was power breakdown for weeks, for months, you know. People didn't have access to clean water, no internet. So there were lots of different issues. And then obviously people who saw that, who experienced that firsthand, you know, people, there were people who evacuated, but then there were people who stayed. And, you know, the PTSD that they're still going through. I mean, this is the kind of humanizing of climate stories that I'm talking about. And this is sort of a dream project, you know, documenting the journey of people who've seen these, you know, months after what they've been through, or maybe even years after, because I do know that they're really, really impactful. Because, and one of the reasons why I stepped into the climate journalism space is also sort of, you know, an experience that I've had a little earlier in my life. So I'd like to tell you a story. I was actually 15-ish years ago in 2005. So yeah, 15 and a half now. I was in the US and I was here on an exchange program. And I was with a Jewish host family, and this person from my host community, he took me to Mississippi for Hurricane Katrina relief efforts. And I went there, I stayed there in the church for an entire week, and participated in the relief efforts, tried to do some community service. And that experience, you know, just meeting people there and, you know, seeing that rubble after months of that disaster, it was just a very, very, you know, I don't know, it was just an experience that was so real for me at that time. And that really impacted me, which is one of the reasons that I really felt that this should be one of my causes, if not my only cause, you know. And so I'm here now, finally, after all these years.
Yeah, I'm fascinated about this kind of experience that you have, you know, for one, you know, staying with a Jewish family, but for two, kind of this experience that you have talking to survivors of obviously a horrible environmental disaster in the southeast of the U.S., but obviously, you know, survivors of an environmental disaster in a country that is meant to offer them far more support than your home country, obviously Pakistan. What are some of the kind of thoughts and feelings that went through your mind as you were talking to these kind of survivors in Louisiana? Did you have any kind of sense of comparing to the kind of victims of similar incidents back home, or what were some of the kind of, you know, ideas floating around your mind?
It was actually a little graphic also for me, because last year only in Karachi we saw, and in last year I was in Karachi actually, and in August there were very, very severe rainfalls, like, you know, as I already said, that there the pattern of rainfalls is very erratic. And in Karachi, there were, so it was just, it was pouring down, and, you know, there was a lot of urban flooding. And so obviously I got a little scared also, but just seeing that and going through that and seeing people suffer, there were so many parts of the city, like, you know, the more marginalized and, you know, impoverished neighborhoods, they were obviously, you know, suffering a lot more. And actually in Karachi, like, you know, there's this area where people pay a lot of money to, you know, rent a space, or, like, you know, the homes or the properties in that area are very, very expensive also. And it's technically known as one of the, you know, more affluent areas in Karachi. And actually they were also suffering very much, because, you know, the water was, there was just too much water, and people opened their homes for people. There were lots of tweets. Religious organizations opened doors to people who were stranded. And so when these survivors that I was talking to, and obviously I wasn't there, but like when I did my interviews via phone and via Zoom and all, and a lot of these people, when they started telling me their stories, it was just graphic for me. Like, you know, I could think about that experience when I had in August. But obviously it wasn't the same, you know, but nonetheless, when somebody starts telling you, you try to relate that to some event that you've had.
Did you ever have that sense of kind of seeing connections between the people in Louisiana and people maybe in Karachi?
There's suffering, and, you know, people generally look up to, you know, the authorities, and they expect that, you know, there will be adequate, you know, there would be a proper fit response from the government. And even when the government tries, you know, at times, but still people who are in those shoes, their suffering is just, you know, like whoever you talk to. I did have the opportunity to talk to a friend from California also after the wildfires last year. And, you know, even she said that, like, you know, the suffering is pretty much the same. Like, you know, whoever goes through any kind of issues, people just suffer, and, you know, they're helpless, and they try to reach out to as many people as they can, because, you know, they do need help. And like, this is something, and which is the reason why, you know, climate as a cause and the environment as a cause should unite humanity, because it doesn't discriminate. It doesn't see, you know, it doesn't discriminate on the basis of your ethnicity or your race or your gender or whatever, you know. It's just there, and it's the biggest existential threat for all of humanity. And so there are lots of similarities in terms of, you know, how people perceive these things and then how people react.
It's interesting you say that, that climate change doesn't discriminate. It obviously does kind of affect people all around the world. But I've really enjoyed, you know, the kind of very simple response to when people say we're all in the same boat, and they say, no, we're all in the same ocean, and we all have different sizes of boats and different types of sailing vessels, and some are kind of latching onto maybe some driftwood. I just kind of also wonder, do you feel at all, and this might be kind of a guilty sense, that you know, people in the US don't really understand what the climate crisis is like for people in places like Karachi and maybe in kind of some of the mountain communities in Pakistan? Do you feel like there is that sense of lack of recognition for what, you know, climate crisis really means? Or do you feel maybe that people in the US, and maybe particularly these people you spoke with in Louisiana, had a real accurate sense of that and had a real accurate sense of kind of, you know, the kind of, maybe like you said, the shared suffering, but also the inequality that's built into that?
That is obviously, you know, an important question. And I think it's more of, you know, a social justice issue and more of a political issue. And yes, obviously there is no denying that, you know, there's one of the two countries is more privileged than the other, you know, and the way people suffer in one country and the way people suffer in the other country is obviously different. But yeah, having said that, I do feel that people who are not the victims or survivors, if, you know, for the lack of a better word, other than those people, like if you go to the general population, people who do understand climate and, although I don't know, like, you know, I've met maybe like a couple of climate deniers, not many because of, you know, the people that I hang out with. And, you know, I do know a lot of activists and all, but, otherwise, like, you know, generally speaking, people do understand, you know, the sufferings, especially people who are aware of, you know, the disasters and, you know, what it does. But yes, I haven't had a lot of conversations with people who don't believe in this. So my experiences are a little limited there.
All right, that's fair enough. And obviously kind of, you know, that's exactly why you're at school, to kind of learn more about that and maybe kind of, you know, we can have another conversation in 6 months' time and you might have an entirely different perspective on that. And I think that's the wonderful opportunity of going to school. Sometimes I get jealous. I feel like I should head back to school. You can just kind of sit and learn things and change your perspective all the time. It's kind of incredible. But obviously after you graduate, you're going to kind of, you know, you're going to want to make your mark on the world. What do you kind of, is your next career step to try and, you know, make your mark in kind of the US media market, or is it to try and come back to Pakistan and maybe kind of, do you have a dream publication in Pakistan?
I have a bunch of dream publications, but they are not Pakistan based. One of them is based in the US, and there are two other international publications or portals that are my benchmarks, and that are obviously my dream places to work at. So to name them, the first and the foremost is New York Times Climate, which is like, you know, because they do some wonderful work and, you know, provide a lot of context to climate and the humanizing of climate stories. I've read a bunch of really, really good stories on NYT Climate. Then there is The Guardian, based in the UK, and there's Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is doing a wonderful job in terms of, you know, their political coverage also, but then they also do other stories Nat Geo might also be a really, really good place to be at. But yeah, I would love to start whoever takes me in, like, you know, because every place, and it's generally like, you know, it's a known fact that smaller places teach you more because you end up doing a lot more on your own. So I would like to really try out some local outlets and you know, just talk to people on ground, do some local reporting, and then maybe move on to any of these international portals.
All right. Well, I wish you the best of luck for that. And thank you so much for kind of chatting with us today. It's obviously quite late for you in New York. For anyone who's been listening to this and wants to kind of check out some of your work, where can they find it? And you know, where might they be able to look for your work in the future?
So I am publishing some work with Pavement Pieces, which is our university. Like, it's the publication of my concentration. So all of the work that we produce, films, audio, photo work, print, whatever, that is published there. I've also done a few stories for Global Voices, a bunch of them on climate and ecology and the environment. So Global Voices is one, and Pavement is one, and then obviously now Climate Tracker.
Awesome. Well, I hope that kind of list only continues to grow. And thank you so much for chatting with us. Thank you for kind of, you know, sharing some of that interesting experience between Pakistan and the US. I think it's kind of fascinating what you could probably develop comparing those experiences and comparing kind of the real world that you're seeing and kind of encountering, you know, in both countries. So I'm excited to read what you come up with in the future. And thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure.
And that's it for the show. I'm Chris Wright, as you know, and this is Climate Tracker Weekly. For comments, suggestions, and feedback, you can email us at podcast@climatetracker.org. If you're listening on Apple Podcast, please leave us a comment. It helps new listeners to find us, and it makes me feel better about life as well. I'm not exactly the saddest person in the world, but, you know, I could be happier. So if you leave a comment, you'll make me happier. Subscribe to our newsletter and visit our website. Join us again next time for another episode of Climate Tracker Weekly in another part of the world with another interesting young journalist. See you then.